Well, good evening, brethren and sisters and young people. Thank you for coming to tonight's address, because this is one which is very important for us all, young and old. It's a very serious one, and particularly young people, as you've got a lot of decisions ahead of you, important decisions, baptism, marriage, career, all those sorts of things. You are at a crossroads in a good many of those areas, any one of which, if you make the wrong decision, well, to put it very bluntly, could be the end of you, certainly spiritually. And look, I don't want to be totally negative here tonight. There's a lot of things that we could say that are negative, and we will say some negative things, but I do want to keep it positive. Look, there's a very rich prospect for leadership that we need to embrace, and I want to talk about some of the positive things that we can use in our families, practical things that can help us along the way. Firstly, we have the very difficult question of what on earth is leadership? And I don't know whether you've actually thought about this, but leadership is an extremely slippery idea. If you Google the word leadership, you better have about 3 days worth of time to just think about it, because there's so much and so many competing definitions of what's leadership. Frankly, it's overwhelming. And for me, that's just too much. I don't have the time, and I guess really what I'm saying is I don't have the patience to wade through all the academic bits and pieces. Except to say that I tend to sort of know leadership when I see it. Sadly, and I'm not talking about my family now, I'm talking about in my work life, I haven't seen a lot of good leaders. The sort of leaders that inspire you and just draw you forward, and you can embrace a concept and embrace what they're on about and all that sort of thing. But there was one study that I want to share with you. It was around about a bit over 10 years ago now, in the Harvard Business Review. They actually looked at leadership from a totally different angle. Now, I know that's not scripture, but what they came up with does impact upon our interpretation, our understanding of scripture, because it was very, very interesting. What they did, the Harvard Business Review, is they said, well, let's scrap all the definitions of leadership. Let's sort of get away, you know, is it transactional leadership, or is it, you know, some? And you sort of think, oh, you know, can't get my head around that. Let's just look at leadership in action and see if we can find something about where we see leadership in action, and see if we can sort of put it all together and find some common threads. So what they did is, about 10 or so years ago, they looked for outstanding business performance and proxied that that might be a way of seeing whether there's outstanding business leadership of those businesses that they were reviewing. And they reviewed thousands of businesses. And they distilled all these things, and it was a very rigorous process. And thousands of companies and businesses were looked at, and they only came up with 5 companies that satisfied their very tight definition or their understanding of what success in business was all about. And they said, okay, we've got these 5 companies. And they weren't the big name companies. They were companies often that you hadn't heard of. In fact, I don't think any of the top 500 companies in the world appeared in this list of 5, which is surprising. In other words, the top business leadership wasn't shown in the top 500 companies. General Electric, for example, didn't make a cut. In fact, General Electric bowed out, not early on, but wasn't near the top at all. So we're talking about the elite level of leadership, and they were not well-known companies. One was a bank, and the others were local, regional sort of companies across the world, but a number of them were in the US. And what they did, we've got 5, we don't know who they are, but they all satisfy our understanding of good business performance which suggests good business leadership. So why don't we just go and interview the chief executive of each of the five companies? They've only got five. That's not hard work. And guess what they found? You are spot on. All of the five leaders, firstly, they found that the five leaders of the company were the same person. Sadly, sisters and young girls, there were no females. It was all men. Tends to be that way, unfortunately, or fortunately. Depends how you want to view things. But you're right. They weren't your typical stereotype of leader. You know, that gung-ho, follow me, we'll take them on, and, you know, all that. Weren't like that at all. Very humble men. Diminutive sort of people. People who didn't project themselves, who didn't want to necessarily be in the limelight. In fact, one of them was a guy who'd been in this company for 20 years. And this is an interesting story. They interviewed him. They said, okay, so why are you so successful? And he said, for 20 years I've been trying to prove to the board that I'm a leader. Because 20 years ago they said, the chief executive 20 years ago resigned. And they said, oh dear, well, we're going to have to put somebody in the job. Do you think, he was the finance manager, do you think you could sit in the job for a little while till we look for a leader to take over? And he said, oh, okay, well, if you think that I'm good enough, I'm not sure that I am, but if you think that I'm, he was a humble man. And he got in the job and he just worked hard and they just kept, you know, have you found the guy yet? No, not yet, just stay there. And 20 years later, he's still in the job. I'm still trying to prove to them that I am a good leader. He was a very humble person. And here's something for all of those. Now, somebody asked me today, oh, you know, how does a person like you live in the back blocks of New South Wales? You know, you're sort of, you know, you come up here and you a bit of a show-offy sort of style or whatever. Look, I'm one of the worst introverts around, and that's true. I mean, this isn't false modesty. You know, you don't live in Western New South Wales for social reasons, unless you love sheep. And they were all these guys were introverts. All of them, the whole five of them. In fact, one guy couldn't answer the question. They asked him, you know, so what's the keys to your success? What do you? He said, oh dear, I've got to think about this. You know, I'm not sure. You know, never thought about it. And he was a very introvert. No, by no means a charismatic person. And here's the other thing which I found interesting. All of them were deeply religious men. Deeply religious, with a servant-like attitude. And the other thing that they had, which I was very impressed with, and we've been talking about this with James, and we'll continue to talk about with this in James across the weekend, they were a highly focused, single-minded person. They would say things like, in 3 years, we will be doing whatever, you know, we'll be out of this business and into this other business. In 3 years, this is where we're going. You got it? Understand, everybody? Good communication at reinforcing where they're going. No question about where they're taking the organisation. In fact, one of them, introverted sort of guy, he was sitting there in a conference and one of his lieutenants got up and he said, you know, sprouting the company line, and he said, this was 6 months after the chief executive had said, in 3 years we're going to be at wherever we're going to be. And he got up, and he was an extroverted sort of speaker, and he got up and, well, in 3 years' time, you know, Fred Banana Company, we're going to go here and, you know, we're going to take on the world and all this. And the guy, little diminutive chief executive, said, hold on, no. I said that 6 months ago. It's not 3 years. You've now got 2.5 years. Totally focused on where he's going. That's the sort of leadership that from the world works. And those elements and more, and we'll get to the more in a moment, those elements of leadership are the sort of things that we need in our families and in our ecclesias. Now, I'm not here to bag out brethren, I mean, obviously. And in particular, I'm not here to bag out fathers. But we do have a crisis in Western society of the absence of fathers. And it's a problem. And I'm not going to be, you know, make it so that we get a guilt trip and we think, oh, well, yet another guilt trip laid on me, you know, I'm trying my hardest and yet he tells me I'm not a decent father anymore. Look, it's a tough gig and I know that, and I'm on the second litter and you know, you think you'd learn something the first time round. Well, no, sorry, this guy's hard, made of wood or something. And, I struggle. Seriously, I do struggle. And fatherhood is very difficult because everything is changing around you so much that you wonder, look, you know, could you just put something on freeze hold for a moment so that I can get some things right? And that's why I said to you, I think it was, I can't remember which session, for me, one of the most important things at being a father and trying to lead a family, and I don't have the luxury that you've got of having support from a very lovely and very large ecclesia, and I'm not, you know, it's not a pity party, but I'm just simply saying that, you know, I've got to sort of step in the breach. And look, honestly, that's not my natural state. It's not something that I particularly, you know, I'm not complaining about this. My natural state is to go and sit in a corner and read a book. Now, that's absence. That's absenteeism fatherhood. And the world is full of absenteeism fatherhood. And it's full of it for other reasons. I'm sure this is happening in Perth as much as it's happening in the East Coast. Our jobs suck up all our time and energy. Now, I don't know whether this is true here, but and I live in a part of the world which is relatively quiet. And you'd think, well, you know, it's not as fast-paced as, say, Sydney or Melbourne. Well, you know, we have to work and think about issues and strategize and all that sort of stuff. And when you come home, you're finished. You just don't want to lead. And it sucks the energy out of you. So let me tell you this story. It is a true story. It happened in the United States. And I think some of you might have even heard this story. I might have said it before. I think it was the Hallmark Greeting Card Company. You know the Hallmark, you know, you get, they're not your cheap Chinese one, it's at the reject shop. they're the you know, $5 jobs where you get a decent card and advice. And the marketers in the Hallmark Greeting Card Company had a brilliant idea one year. And it was brilliant. It was a brilliant marketing concept. Somebody in the marketing department said, hey, look, there's a huge prison population in the United States. And Mother's Day is coming up. Why don't we do something? Why don't we offer to every... Do they call them prisoners still? I don't know. Anyway, let's call them prisoners. Every prisoner in the United States system, let's offer them at no expense to them. We will pay. We will offer them to send at our expense. They can choose whichever one they like. We'll give them a selection. A Mother's Day card to Mum for Mother's Day. And so someone said, well, how many do you think we will need? Oh, I don't know. You know, this is an unknown population. We don't normally do surveys on prisons. So they had a print run. And they went out to all the prisons in the United States. And they said, okay, it's free to... And we'll post the letter and all that sort of stuff. So they offered it and the print... Poof, they're all gone. Oh, we better do another print run. So quickly they got another print run. They put it out. And they went to the third print run. Everyone wanted to send Mum a Mother's Day card. Wow. And that was all paid for. So, guess what happens later in the year? I'm guessing it's later in the year, September in our year anyway, comes Father's Day. So come Father's Day, they thought, well, look, it worked so fabulously well for Mother's Day, why don't we do the same? How many do you reckon we get? Oh, well, you know, we had three print runs before. We'll have to, you know, roughly think around that term. So they get this print run going, and same offer, same everything. Couldn't get rid of the first print run. No one wanted to send Dad a card for Father's Day. He's the reason why I'm here. Where was my dad when I needed him? Where was the direction in my life? Dad was absent. Dad belted mum. I wouldn't dare send him a Father's Day card. True story. There was an absence in their sons' lives of Dad, and Dad had become an object of hatred. And fatherhood and leadership go together. They're synonymous terms. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Ephesians 6, verse 4. Fathers, doesn't say mum. Even though, let me assure you, sisters and young girls, mums are hugely important in the work of raising citizens for Zion. I don't know whether this is true. I think it might be. But it's been said that if you want to shape a person into whoever he is or she is to be later in life, the first 5 years, and I think it's even less than that, the first 3 years are critical in the development of the child into a man and beyond. And who is the most critical person in the first 3 years of a child's life? It's mum. Absolutely critical. Look, I'm not into flattery. I'm not trying to even attempt it. But I just want to lay claim to something. Sisters, sometimes you might think that we live in a fairly patriarchal sort of community. You know, brethren speak and pray and all that sort of thing. And you think, well, you know, we're sort of second rate. I think the exact opposite. I can think of nothing more special, powerful, and effective than good motherhood, particularly if that statistic is true, that the first 3 or 5 years of a child's life defines that child for the rest of his or her life. Mums have got an absolutely critical role to play. So I'm not in any way taking away from that. And sisters and young girls who hopefully will be mothers eventually. Look, you have every bit of our collective brethren's respect for your job. And I'm going to apologise on behalf of the other brethren in this room. We've let you down on many occasions. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but fathers, bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. So in your families, fathers have got to get back into the driver's seat and not have this Western influence of mum being the one who sort of has to do all the heavy lifting of nurture and admonition and parenting. When I was a boy, and I loved, he's now passed away, sadly, I loved my dad, but my dad was from the old school, and my dad was very much a person who, you know, he was an honest, faithful man, and he was a great partner for my mum, 64 years married, and for 67 years, my mother had one man in her life. And it was a beautiful marriage, truly. And I thank God for that. Even though they're not in the meeting, but hey, I thank God for that. I think it was great. And if they're, you know, I'll let others be the judge. But if there's anything that I can look back on and say, well, heck, a lot of choices in my life and bad choices weren't made, well, I'm going to thank my parents for that. But I will say this, Dad was absent a bit too much. Now, I know he had to work and he had a hard job and, you know, he put food on the table. I accept all of that and I'm not in any way going to take away from the credit that belongs to my dad. But Dad was your typical old school dad. He sat at the end of the dining room table. He was the patriarchal figure. He was the boss. And he had a good sense of humour. I do remember that. But sadly, Dad was always right. And when Dad was wrong, he was always right, if you know what I mean. And it was all a sort of a choreography sort of event to try and get round that embarrassing situation that Dad, well, he actually was wrong, but, well, we can't sort of, you know, because he's Dad. And he was a little bit aloof and a bit austere. I don't want to get into show and tell, but he wasn't your cuddly, sit on your lap type dad, because he came from that old age or that old school where, well, men don't cry and all that sort of thing. And I found that a real issue in my teens, that I didn't have a dad that I could really sidle up to and be partnered with. Mum was different. She was a softer person, as a good many of you, I'm sure, are. But my dad, remember we talked about culture this morning? My dad imbued that culture. And he didn't let go of that culture, or he didn't question the culture. And the culture for us is for dads, we've got to be more engaged in parenting and in the lives of our children. We've got to be more connected, a deeper relationship. And if that means, and I know this is a hard choice, I won't go into details, but that choice was made for me, so I thank God for that. But, you know, the allurement of promotion and riches, it was is a very real allurement, but it comes with a price tag. And the price tag is you spend more time at work, travelling, this where, you know, doing whatever you've got to do for Charlie Brown and company, and you just have to devote yourself. And I do know of brethren who've made some pretty tough decisions, and I admire them for this, where they've said no. And they've left companies or refused promotions at great cost and said, no, my family come first. And their families are a lot better for it. In fact, there is an expression, I don't know whether you've heard of it. How does a teenager spell the word love? Someone said it. Who was it? Put your hand up. T-I-M-E. That's how you spell love. And dads say, I'll do anything else. You want an iPhone? I'll give you an iPhone. You want a motorbike? I'll give you a motorbike. But I won't give you time. I don't have time. Too busy. I know on the East Coast where people... I can't get too personal here. No, it's not in the ecclesia, trust me, where they're just hanging out for the time that they can shove their kids into boarding school so that the professional couple can then skyrocket with their careers to go to greater heights. Why, I don't know, but anyway. So their kids outsource parenting to some posh boarding school in Sydney. Don't ever fall for any of that. And we've got a culture which is really, in my opinion, very sick in those areas. Okay. Because the reason why love is spelled T-I-M-E is because children and young adults have this horrible tendency, if you want to call it that, of asking questions. Dad, if the propeller goes counterclockwise and the motor's going at so many revolutions, wouldn't that put a shear force on? And you think, by this time you're thinking, oh, dear, a propeller. Oh, yes, that's right. Those things they used to have in World War II. And, you know, and before you know it, A, you're out of your depth, and B, you're not connecting. Go and ask Uncle So-and-so or Mum or the dog or anybody, but don't ask me. What do you think would happen if a series of those questions was put to you? Because let me tell you, and I'm not attempting blasphemy here, when you are very, very young, I remember this as a little kid, you almost equate your dad with God. And your picture of God is often modelled on what you know about your dad. And if your dad is absent, not interested, won't answer questions, austere or whatever, you use all the superlatives that you like, your picture of God, oh, well, God's disinterested and God's up there and he's so busy with looking after the Milky Way and everything else that, you know, I've just got to get on with my little mud puddle and he's not interested in where I'm at. And that's your picture of God because it's modelled on your dad. But if your dad is engaged and with you and down in the trenches with you, that's your picture of God. So dads, we've got to buy into that. We've got to buy into their psyche. They ask questions. And when they get answers, it's just so wonderful. And a lot of people, and dads in particular, they say, well, I don't seem to have that problem. My kids don't seem to ask as many questions as you're claiming that they want to ask. And, you know, I think you're wrong. You know what's happened? The children have given up asking questions because dad fobs them off or doesn't answer them or gives them, you know, 10 seconds of an answer, which is not really an answer at all. And they just think, well, I don't go to dad to answer things. I'll go somewhere else. And the somewhere else might be in places that you don't want your children to get answers from. So dads, we've got to step up. We've got to show leadership. And leadership involves time and it involves service. And if we're not prepared to do that, I really think we're going to downstream have lots of problems. Here's one of the problems. Here's one of the problems. We talked about it this morning. Everyone, particularly children who will become teenagers and young adults, everyone has a need to belong. Think if you were cut off from your family members who love you for whatever reason. I'm not, you know, whatever reason. But if one of those reasons is abandonment, okay, think of that. That's a real hard one. Think if you were abandoned by your family or that you were cut off for whatever reason from your ecclesia and you're going through life relatively speaking, alone. I think psychologically that would be damaging. Why does God give us families? Why does God give us ecclesias? Dare I say it, I don't know a lot about your situation, but if it's anything like every other ecclesia that I know about, including my own, which is of 3 members, you have issues, you have problems, you don't always get on with each other. But hey, God's given you the ecclesial family for your benefit, and it is not a bad place. You know, when I came into the truth, when I was in, I first came along to a lecture when I was 16. I felt all of a sudden it was a home. And quite apart from the intellectual thing and learning the truth and all that sort of stuff, he was home. He was a place that I could meet people, and if I had an issue that I needed sorting out, I could. There were various ones I knew I could go to, and I talked about one this morning who's now sadly passed away, who I could go to and say, look, can I just have some time with you? I just want to sort something out. I want to bounce some ideas off you. Or I've got a decision to make. I don't really know what to do. Can you just sort of listen? And this isn't me, but I will say it. You know the scripture where it says you have many instructors, but you don't have many fathers? That applies today as much as it's ever applied in any other age. In fact, perhaps it applies more so today. You know, I don't altogether have a problem with this, brethren and sisters, but when we get a talk which is full of Hebrew and Greek, which frankly I have no, you know, I'm not even going to pretend to be a Hebrew and Greek scholar, and you know they talk about all, and if you're into that, that's great, please don't think I'm bagging that out, but to put it bluntly, it doesn't altogether wash with me. If that Greek word means that, something very good, yeah, okay. So what does it mean? How does that involve change in me? In fact, I do recall one brother when I was learning the truth and I was baptised, and the ecclesia that I went to was much smaller than your ecclesia, and it wasn't a question of do you feel that God has given you a talent in speaking. It was a question of we've got you booked in 3 months ahead to do an exhortation, and you think, what? And because the ecclesia was so small, and you know, if you fell on your face, who cares? It was just a small group. But brethren, sisters, you know, back then, I guess I was full of all this apparent knowledge of Hebrew and Greek, and you know, echoes in the Bible and all that sort of thing, which is very interesting. I accept all that. But then a brother came up to me, or I came up to him one day, and I said to him, so how did you think that talk went? You know, I was only young. And he said, oh, I suppose it was all right. Now, please don't do that to me. I bruise easily. And I said, well, okay, you know, I knew him fairly well. So, okay, out with it. What's the go here? He said, well, you didn't strike at the heart. You just talked a lot of pseudo-academic stuff. Okay, so we learned a bit of Greek that you don't know anyway, and you just learned it from somewhere. And it didn't really make an impact on anybody, and we all gone away thinking, well, so what? What's for supper? And it dawned on me that we need stuff that affects the heart from the speaking platform, but that's the difference between an instructor and a father. We desperately need, brethren and sisters, in the meeting as much as in our families, fathers who can wrap it up together and make everybody feel as though they belong somewhere, that they are valued, that they have a contribution that others value and they feel worthy. You imagine that. If you belonged in a place where, I'm not saying there can't be judgment, but it's the sort of judgment that is positive and helpful, and you belonged in that family or that ecclesia or both, I tell you what, you'd want to come every Sunday. You'd want to be at your family all the time. It's a wonderful supportive thing. Do you think that the level of suicide in youth in Australia would be as great as it is if the families were intact and vibrant and fathers were there leading? And that's out there. When you belong somewhere, you're no longer restless. You've got a place. You've got a role. You grow. You experience joy. You experience a positive sense of the future. Today, sadly, there are, well, not many communities. There's a lot of disconnect, at least what I see. There's a lot of disconnect. And the biggest disconnect, if you want sort of a cameo of, or an icon of what that disconnect looks like, I actually had this conversation the other day at work with someone, and they just were speaking as though this was the most normal, natural thing, about dinner time in most families is not at the table together. And somebody's over here having their, you know, microwave dinner, and they're there, and someone at another time, or at least distant, is having their dinner, and they've got their iPad, and everything's disconnected, and we're all atomised in society. There's no connections. There's no bonding anymore. There's no belonging. And fathers, leadership in a godless age, is reversing that cultural trend and forcing the connections. So, And we do this not successfully terribly much, I'd have to say, but we've made it a rule that after dinner is served and all that, we sit down and we have our Bible reading. It might only go for 20 minutes, and it might only be half a chapter, but we dig down on that chapter, and we, as I said earlier, we pick up the one thing out of that chapter that might be relevant for the ages of the people that are in the family, and we just play on that, and it's the last thing, particularly for my young boys, that they have with them as they go to bed. Now, I'm hoping, I'm guessing, that built up over time. There's 365 days in the year, and over time they just build up this sort of inventory of lessons that they learnt in that 20-minute period with the family, with mum and dad. Okay. The disconnects have to be worked against. The culture will not help you. Husbands work away oftentimes. I have to travel a lot in my job, and I resist it a fair bit. Oftentimes the wife has to work and work away. And I'm not bagging out sisters for that. It's a tough economic situation, and I know that here in Perth it's a tough gig. And wives often have to do that. Children go to school and they're away. Now, I'm not saying that you're all bad, that you don't homeschool like we do. We do it for other reasons. It's just that there's nothing. We don't have Heritage College where we are. And if we did, we'd probably send our kids there. So, you know, but your children are away, and in our case, they're imbibing all the culture of the world, either directly or indirectly. For example, tell me, oh well, I shouldn't ask a question I don't already know the answer, and I don't know the answer in Perth, but in New South Wales, it's a compulsory subject for our higher school certificate, whatever your version of that is, I don't know what it is, but the year 12 thing, it's a compulsory subject, is English. Now, I don't have a problem with that in principle, but you know what English is in New South Wales? It's not English. It's social engineering. It's dealing with novels that are ungodly. It's dealing with concepts of tolerance for things that God condemns. It's social engineering. They call it English. It's, you know, all English, you know, what's, can't be anything wrong with English. But it's not. And so you've got this huge wave of what I would call corruption sort of being put into the minds of your children, and you've got to untangle that when they come home from school. So, and please don't think I'm anti if you send yourself to school, any school. That's just the law. That's just the way things are. We've chosen homeschooling, and, you know, we're going to have to teach those things. So children away. And the other thing that this society does breed, excessively so I would suggest, is a level of independence. We're all independent. Western society is built on freedom and liberty and independence. You can be whoever you want to be, you as an individual. It's not collective. Asian societies are far more collegiate. Japan, for example, and Korea, where Sister Yun comes from, far more collegiate, far more compliant. But we're all individuals, and we love that individual. So we get all our little cars, our gadgets, our own rooms, our own lifestyle choices, all that sort of stuff. Don't you touch me. I won't judge you. You know, we'll just all live in our little world of one. And we're depressed and suicidal because we don't belong other than in our little world of one. Okay. Now, for the next part of our talk, I want to show you some elements of good leadership, good relationships that can exist in any, in husband and wife, mother to children, father to children, even in your work situation, anything that might help you to think about how you're going to approach leadership in relationships from here on. Okay, and the way I'm going to do this is that it's captured in half a dozen words that start with R. And the first word is respect. What is respect? It's incidentally, this is the oxygen of a relationship. Any relationship, if it doesn't have this, frankly, it's not a relationship. It's tyranny. It's brutality. It's dictatorship. If you don't have respect, I think that you might as well just not waste your time on the other five R's that we're going to talk about. This is the most important one in any relationship, in any aspect of leadership, and especially
in the home and in the ecclesia, and particularly, if I'm allowed to say it, of fathers in the ecclesia. Okay, first one is respect. What is respect?
Well, it's probably a number of things, but I'm going to suggest that the most important part of respect in a relationship and leadership in a relationship is that you value differences. Look, Brother Rob might be offended by this, but if all of us were accountants in this room, it would be a very easy and, collegiate sort of thing. We'd all talk that funny mumbo-jumbo that they talk about, and, did your ledger balance? Oh, my ledger balanced. And I'm going, yes, right. Okay, so it's easy when we're all the same. See what I'm saying? But true respect, it's easy to respect somebody who is you, who's a clone. But respecting and valuing differences is really a powerful thing in a relationship, that when you're respected and you're different, but you feel that in spite of your differences, perhaps even because of your differences, you belong, hey, you can feel the energy rise within you. Valuing differences is what respect is all about. Now, what are those differences? Well, age, personality, gender, appearance, health, ethnicity, experience, goals. They're all things that make us different. And let's celebrate those differences. Celebrate them. Enjoy them. Drill down with them. Make them sing, because those differences are powerful. If everybody in the Australian cricket team was a batsman, would we win? Oh, we'd get a good score in the first innings, but the next people, the opponents who get in, we haven't got a bowler. So they're going to belt us out of the whacker. See, you've got to have that teamwork is all about differences, and each plays on each other. You know, there's my grandmother's hand, whom I love, who came from Perth. She's a lovely old stick. She was a lovely old thing. I loved her intensely. She had a beautiful sense of humour. And, you know, and there's me listening, you know, picking up on what she's got to say and all those things that happened in the early 1900s. Personality. Now, here's one that is a real controversial one. What happens when you're courting and opposites attract? Don't they? Different personalities attract. You know, you're attracted to somebody who's not you. They might be bubbly and effervescent, and you're a stay-at-home, boring type, like me. What happens when you marry someone who's opposite to your personality? If while you're courting, opposites attract, what happens to opposites when you're married? Opposites attack. I won't mention names, but I know of, both dead now, a couple who for at least 25 years, or at least the first 25 years of their marriage, they tried to re-engineer each other's personality. And they attacked each other daily. Let me just share something with you, and I don't know the neuroscience. I'm not even going to go there, other than to say I think personality is pretty much God-given. Character isn't, by the way. You know, characters have to be formed, and whatever personality you've got, you must have a godly character. So we're not going down character. We're talking about personality. And too many people confuse the two. Oh, I've got to change that person. She's too bubbly and effervescent. She's always
talking amongst the sisters, and you know what sisters do when they do? They gossip, and you know, she must be the head gossiping, and away it goes, all this judgment. That's just sheer nonsense. Character is the only thing that God asks us to change. Personality, I think, is hardwired into you. Let me prove it to you. And I won't use anybody else, because this is embarrassing, other than myself. Look, I'm not an extrovert. I'd love to be one of those people who just swan into the room and, you know, just, you know, all that sort of stuff and can just walk up to the platform. It takes me an age to get up. Seriously, it takes me an age to get up. I've got to go over my notes and I've got to sit in darkened space and I've got to, you know, do all of that. And I think, how do these other people just waltz up to the platform and they can do, well, I don't know. And frankly, that's just the way life is. Get used to it. Because my personality is far more intense, believe it or not. Okay? Now, I tried, you know all those tests that you do, those personality tests? I tried 3 different tests. And I tried to rig them so that I'd come out, hey, for a day at least I'll be an extrovert. And you know what? I couldn't even falsify the test. It came out, would you believe, seriously, it came out that your personality was described as melancholic. How would you like that, eh? You know? Anyway. So, hey, celebrate those differences, accept those differences, and don't try and change people. You know, it's like preferences. If somebody likes pasta and somebody else likes a steak, that's just almost like personality. It's just your different preferences. Get over it. Don't try and impose and project everything about you onto the other person and just, you know, collapse the relationship. Here's the other thing that I think is an example of disrespect. Anger. In any relationship where there is anger, I think there's probably bitterness and lack of respect in the relationship. When it says, don't let the sun go down on your anger, I think that's a beautiful scripture. In other words, sort it out early on. Don't brood and carry on and, you know, you sleep on that side of the bed and she's on that side and you're about to fall off on that side. And, you know, it's no talkies and all that. Forget all that. Don't let the sun go down on your anger. Here's another example of anger. Provoke not your children to wrath, Dad. And I know I have shared this with you before. I will share it with you again because I'm not a... it's something that happened to me. One of my sons. I lost my temper with one of my sons. He'd been provoking me. And we'd had some real difficult moments. And I blew it big time. Out of control. Undisciplined tongue. I didn't swear. But if I could have, I would have. And I tore him to shreds. I broke him. He was a young teenager. I don't say this with any great relish. And I went off to my study, which is sort of my comfort zone. And I prayed to God and I said, look, I did the wrong thing. And please forgive me. But that ain't enough. I'd broken somebody. So I went out of my study over to his bedroom. And it felt like it was about 43 kilometres from the study to the bedroom. It was such a long, arduous journey. And I just stood at the door. And I just said, I've asked forgiveness from God. I'm now asking forgiveness from you. He broke down. Why was it so hard for me to do? You know why? Because I'd imbibed the culture which said, well, you know, almost, Dad's always right. And Dad can't lose face in front of his kids. Oh, no.
And I think we should reinstate, if we're going to put respect of differences, the word forgiveness into our vernacular. We should do that. Okay. One of the most important ones is listening is an act of respect. Listening shows that you're investing in the relationship, not always giving solutions. And brethren, we are wonderful at giving solutions. I mean, our sister wives often come to us and say, look, can I just unburden? And you say, oh, what? Okay, well, have I got a solution for you? And away you go, and you go straight into solution mode, and your sister wife says to you, look, I don't want to hear that. You're always telling me the answers. I just want to unburden. I just want to blow. Please don't always think that you've got to have a screwdriver and to fix things. I just want to share with you. Okay, I just want you to listen. I don't want you to do anything else. I think we should. And fathers, in the ecclesia of God too. You know, there are, I presume so in your own ecclesia, people you could go up to and say, Brother so-and-so, you've had many years around. I just want to unburden myself. I've made this decision, or I think this is the right decision. Can I just share it with you? And I wouldn't mind your comments. And just the act of having somebody listen is so therapeutic. And we should respect the differences and get involved in those differences. For example, if there's a health issue in the relationship, get involved with, being part of that health issue of your spouse or whoever, your child, whatever. If there is an ethnic difference, and of course in our case there is one, and there's a cultural ethnic differences, and we laugh about it from time to time, but there are some real problems from time to time, misunderstandings, because you say things that have a meaning in your language and they're different in another culture, and there are misunderstandings. So you have to be sensitive to those differences. You don't say, well, you're in Australia now, and this is the way we operate, get used. It's not like that at all. The other one is differences of experiences in life, positive and negative, and the differences in goals. And one of the things that, I'll share it again with you tonight, that I would encourage you young people, if you're going to think about marriage, I often say to young people, okay, if you're pretty serious about this girl or this fellow, share your goals with that person. And I knew of one courtship where the fellow shared his goals with this girl. And he said, well, my goals are this, 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 and this. And she said, oh, so that's what you want to do in life. And it was just a complete downer. Yeah, that's really, if you really want to dig deep, and here's the internal sort of, where I really want to go in life in Christ. And she just couldn't buy into it. She wouldn't respect those differences. And I'm not trying to bag her out altogether, other than to say that if you can't get that rapport and that respect going on those things, keep walking. Keep walking. Move on. Here's the other thing too. Respect also requires you, and sisters particularly, or not particularly, but I think of sisters when I think of this one. Young girls, if you're thinking of marrying somebody and you think, wow, he's really this, he's that, and hey, this could be it. How does he respect other women? His mum, his sisters, other sisters in the meeting, how does he respect them? If it's not the way it should be, catch him out on that and say, why do you not treat your mother respectfully? Oh, she's an idiot. Oh, you're not an idiot, she's an idiot.
Oh, I respect you. I don't respect her. She's an idiot. That's a lie. It's the biggest lie. It'll happen to you. Trust me. I know what I'm talking about. Not that it's happened to me, but I've seen it in others. It's a lie. If he's bagging out his sisters, you will be next.
Okay, so it's respect for all of those things there. And one of the things that you should also, if you're in a relationship, and particularly girls, if you're in a relationship, does he respect not only your goals, but your fears? And I often encourage young people, particularly if they're going together, to share their goals and to share their fears. And if you say, and because we're exposed when we express our fears, well, look, I'm really fearful of whatever it is, and I'm sharing it with you. If that person treats that sensitively, then they're showing leadership, and they're showing the most important aspect of leadership, which is respect. If they say, oh, get over it, keep moving. Okay? Well, let's move on. The absence of respect is bitterness. Husbands, love your wives and be not bitter against them. Why does it say that of husbands and not sisters? Husbands, love your wives and be, this is Colossians, and be not bitter against them. Why does it say, you want to know what I think? For the hardness of men's hearts. Maybe, brethren, we have a problem in that area. We are prone to hardness of heart and bitterness. And bitterness can be where you are uncooperative, you are indifferent, you send people on guilt trips, you withdraw physically and emotionally. And one of the biggest aspects of bitterness, it's a real litmus test for bitterness, is if you're always finding fault. And bitterness is so, you know, here we've got the arrows, oh, he said, she said, and it's her fault. You know, one of the things that I remember a marriage counsellor does with couples that are needing to tidy up their marriage is that say, okay, could you give me a list of all his faults, they say to the girl. Could you give me a list of all his faults? You've got 10 minutes. And you say to the fellow, could you give me a list of all her faults? And I know this is actually a true story. And so, you know, in micro print, because you need all the space you can get. And someone said, look, I've run out of space, can I get another page? And away it went, you know, in 10 minutes, you know, just all came out. And then they were, you know, the marriage counsellor saw this and saw the level, we've got a problem here. And then they asked the reverse, okay, now list your own faults. And one sister, sorry to say this, one sister actually, wasn't a sister, one woman actually said, after the 10 minutes, I can't think of one. And she was quite genuine. I'm sorry, I just can't think of one. See how we're blind? See how fault-finding is a sickness, a mental sickness? Once you get in the groove of it, you can't get out of it. Once you get into that bitter, disrespectful thing, and it's all fault-finding and they're to blame and it's all about blame and all that sort of stuff, you've got the end of a relationship. Very dangerous stuff. And brethren, if you're going to lead your family, stand outside yourself, stand outside your family and look at the dynamics of respect. One of the things, and I only say this because if I use somebody else as an example, somebody will feel hurt. We insist in our family that respect must be shown. Now, I've got two boys over there that will vouch for this. When the dinner's put on the table, you go and thank your mother for that. You honour your mother. Oh, but I don't like Brussels sprout. I don't care. She cooked them for you, lovingly, because she cares for you. You thank her. And okay, it might be phony, but they must do that. They must do. They must show respect. Okay. All right, let's move on. There's a lot we could say, but time's marching on. Building respect. Treat her the way God would want you to treat her. Treat him the way God would want you to treat him. Simple. This is relationships 101. Treat others the way God would want you to treat them. End of story. And look, if you have to do it through gritted teeth, if you have to act, if you're a little bit phony about it, do it. There's a saying, fake it till you make it. Show respect even if it's hard and you don't really feel respectful. Just do it. Right. Now, the other R, and this is possibly one of, possibly my favourite, because respect sometimes is a bit negative, but I do love this one, is responsiveness. It's almost like saying teamwork. And we're going to get to this tomorrow for our exhortation, so I'm not going to say too much here. But one of the things that James asks us to do, the wisdom that is from above must show itself in a whole list of things, and one of them is to be easily entreated. Easily entreated. Now that's sort of, you know, King James words for easily persuaded. Being flexible, easy peasy, and all that sort of stuff. You know, it's not a hierarchy in a relationship, and leadership is not all about I said, therefore you must do. Easily entreated means something like it's a nice Sunday afternoon. Where will we go? We've had the meeting, it was a great meeting, you know, blah, blah, blah. Where will we go this afternoon? Would anyone like to go for a drive? Oh, no, we went for a drive last week. Why don't we just go to the beach? Well, we don't have beaches, but, you know, whatever. Easy peasy, and just to go with the flow and not burr up, oh no, this is the third time you've got your way and it's about time I've got, and just go with it. You know, one of the things that, and I did ask this question, I'm not trying to sound self-righteous here, but one of the questions I ask is, so what's the dress standard of your meeting? What do I wear? Oh, well, do you want me to wear a tie? No, it's okay, don't need to wear a tie. If you had have said, yeah, look, you might offend someone if you don't wear a tie. I'll wear a tie. I'll wear three. Look, just go with it. You know, it's is it a big deal? Does it matter? Just don't burr up over stuff that, frankly, doesn't matter. Be responsive. Easily entreated. How do we respond? Well, here are some of the elements of good response. Good responses. First one is be flexible. Be mutually submissive. Now, think about this. Just think about this. I don't care which relationship you put it into, whether it's your marriage, whether it's your children, whether it's your ecclesial life. Imagine that in areas where we are responsive to each other, that your ecclesia, and I hope this is the case already, but okay, I don't know. Imagine your ecclesia or any relationship you're in, even your boss at work, that you're flexible, you're submissive, there's a service attitude, you're adaptable, you're communicative, there's affection, there's sharing. Imagine that in the ecclesia or in your relationship at home amongst the members of your family. Imagine if that was everywhere where you... Wouldn't you want to join that? I reckon that your ecclesia, if it wasn't like this, and maybe it is already, I don't know, but if it wasn't like that, it'll double in size in 12 months. It's a magnet. People want to join. If everyone was like that, wouldn't that be a nice place to belong? Wouldn't you feel at home in an ecclesia where all those things were in, you know, your business meeting wasn't sort of jockeying for power or whatever, but it was all this sort of stuff where people really did get on and are easily entreated. And I'm not talking about people, you know, if somebody comes in and says, well,
you know, I think we should believe in the Trinity and be tolerant. Well, you know, we're not talking about that level of easily entreatedness. What we're talking about is in the things that just really don't matter, be loving and flexible. Okay, well, let's borrow from James. What is our best response in situations? Fathers, mothers, employees, swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. And really, for fathers and leaders, if you do nothing else but take those three things and make them really nail it in your life, I reckon you've got it. You're pretty much really getting there. Be swift to hear. Listen. Don't do your yeah buts. You know what yeah but means? Sorry, someone said it. It means no. Yeah, but you're really saying no. And yeah, but is I'm not listening, I'm giving you an answer. Swift to hear, slow to speak. It doesn't mean you speak slowly, it means you're slow to, you know, you measure, you think, well, I'll give a measured response. And slow to wrath. Oh boy, if we could only get us brethren to get out of the habit of flaring up so much over things that, frankly, we should just listen and be a little bit more attentive to. Okay, so we've got respect, we've got responsiveness, we've got another R coming up. I love this one. I really do. It warms my heart to speak on this one, because this means a lot to a lot of people. Imagine if mum and dad were the best cheerleaders in whatever you did. If you fell on your face, they're there to cheer you on and pick you up and get you back in the saddle and all that sort of stuff. Affirming the other person. Wow. Recognition. I know this might sound a bit gooey and all that sort of stuff, but brethren, I think we should affirm our love for our spouse daily. Affirm it. You're the most beautiful girl in the world. I'm glad I married you. Hey, that tea look tonight was just fantastic, you know? Oh, but, you know, it's boring, we had it last week. No. I loved it. And not phony stuff, you know, not, oh, you've been listening to that silly talk that the guy gave, and, you know, you're just bunging it off. You're just faking it till you make it, well, you're not going to make it. But look, let me tell you something. I went to a training course some years ago, and it was a bizarre training course, and at the end of it, it was a 2 or 3 day training, I can't remember. And it was a fairly technical sort of course on a subject that was a bit dry. But in the end of the course, the things that came up, it was rather bizarre. They said, you work with all these other people, I want you to get a post-it note. I think it was a post-it note. And you're to put Fred on the thing, and you're to tell that person discreetly, it's on a post-it note, what you liked about that person in a training course. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. Well, there are a few people there, they had a good sense of humour, or this or that. And you write it out, blop, 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 and they gave me some stuff. I only got three. And, you know, there were some real tough guys in this course. You know, real. I work for Roads and Maritime, right? And some of these guys are big road workers, you know, eat rusty buckets for breakfast type guys, you know? And you think, oh, they're not going to buy into this. Guess what they, to a man, because it was a male thing, guess what they all took home with them? All their post-it notes. Didn't go in the bin. Not one post-it note was found in the bin. Ah, this silly garbagey stuff, you know, this gooey stuff. No, not one post-it note was found in the bin. Recognition. And you know what? We don't do enough of it. Oh, it might go to her head if I keep telling her how wonderful she is. I'll lay a bet here. Try it. I'll win the bet. It won't go to her head.
Try it.
Recognition. It is absolutely powerful. How do we show recognition? Well, the first thing is praise. We all love a bit of praise. What does Proverbs 31 say? Many daughters have done virtuously, but you are the best. Now, when does he say that? When does the husband say that? You know when he says it? It doesn't quite say it. I'm somewhat imposing my interpretation on it, but I think I'm pretty close to it. You know when he says it? In a 21st century context? At the dinner table. There's dad, there's mum, kids around. Oh, many daughters have done virtuously, but hey, you're the best. Gee, this meal's fantastic. Or, you know, what you did today was great. In front of the children. Oh, there's dad, he's got all the ability.
Well, what does it matter?
What does it matter? Recognition. Absolutely wonderful. And look, you've got that spirit of this young lady's been praised. There she goes. And it just gives you energy. Okay. Here's another R that I find very important. And it's called renewal. And it's something that is not found in the world, particularly in their leadership styles and in their families and in their communities. It is critical in our families and our communities growing spiritually together. Husband and wife. Why do we say that? What does Ephesians 5 say of the husband's responsibility as a leader in his marriage? What does it say? Sorry? Got it? Did you hear that? Wash her with the water of the word. Husbands, do you do that? I don't do it half as much as I should. That's not false humility, that's fact. We are to wash with the water of the word our spouse, our children. We need to renew each other. Otherwise it goes stale and, oh yeah, the same thing day in, day out. We've got to grow spiritually together. And we've got to share spiritual points. And we've got to get out of our little inhibited selves and get out of our studies, you know, where we hibernate sometimes, and share something with our children and our spouse. Wonderful thought. You know, and it doesn't have to be, oh, the Greek words, and away it all goes. It's just, it could be something very minor, but you share it with that person. I know one brother. You know how his way of washing with water of the word his wife and showed leadership in his marriage? You won't believe this. This sounds silly. Do you remember that book? It's still around, I think. Minute Meditations by Brother Bob Lloyd, I think. And guess how long it takes to read? You got it. 1 minute. He reads that to his wife. He reads one every night to his wife. How long does it take? Well, it takes 1 minute. Is that a lot out of your time? Can you spare a minute for your wife? Now, can she not read? You know, is there a problem? Is she dyslexic or something? That we've got to get around this, you know, and it's a therapy. No. You know what I really think? And I'm no expert in this yet, but you know what I really think? I think she just likes to hear the timbre of her husband's voice talking about the things of God. Wow. Why not? That's his way of renewing. There are other ways. Readings, I think that's a powerful one. Look, there's another good reason from a leadership point of view that is very important for readings. And I can say this from experience. Trust me. You have tension in your family over whatever. You know, big things, little things, anything. You've got tension in your family. You know what readings do? If you do it, you know, I don't know, say you do it at 7 o'clock at night every night and you've been doing it consistently for a while. You know what readings do? You've got this tension building up in the house and everyone's a little bit antsy with each other. You know what the readings do? Oh, well, it's 7 o'clock, time for the readings. And boof, away you go. That might only be a 20-minute thing. You know what it does?
after the 20 minutes, and we had a good discussion. Now, what was it we were fuming about before? Oh, I don't know, I can't remember, I don't care. It's a circuit breaker. It relieves the tension. And of course, you don't do the readings just for that, but hey, that's a side benefit that you ought to enjoy. Developing talents, particularly amongst your children. Hey, son, how's it going at school? You've got this assignment, can I help? And you really are passionate about this, whatever it is, favourite thing, bicycling, whatever. Hey, can we do it together? Can I help you with it? And can you show me how you fly that remote control plane that you love so much? Hey, boom. Yeah, let's do it. Developing their talents and their interests and all of that. Be positive. Be future focused. The kingdom's going to come. And even in the time where we occupy till he come, does it have to be all Armageddon? Oh, you know, this and that and all the world's still. It is all that, but if that's all it is, hey, you know, it's just all black. Be future focused. Hey, you wanna go to school and you wanna do this and that, and well, let's see if we can help and let's be part of your future. I think that's just, that's renewal. And I know one brother in the meeting. His father, incidentally, wasn't a great scholar or anything like that, but his son came home with a school assignment and needed a bit of help, and his dad, plodding sort of father in many ways, I don't mean that disrespectfully, he said, well, let's go to the library and let's research this together. Let's learn together. And the mere act of that happening, and I know it's responsiveness as well, but it was part of renewal, that those two are like that. My dad, don't ever speak ill about my dad, he's a great dad. You know, and it just goes, because his dad got down in the trenches with him, future focused, positive, developed his talents, it was great. Okay, now we come to one that is a little bit negative, I've got to tell you. Hard hat on, let's go. Commitment. Now, look. In every relationship, there are times when things go wrong. And you've just got to be committed. And you determine that whatever happens, you will remain actively committed to this relationship. Children, spouse, even ecclesial relationships. Whatever happens, we remain actively committed to each other. And it shows itself, the commitment shows itself in I've got to say this correctly, in consistency. You're consistent. In season, out of season. When you're the same person each day, you're consistent and you're committed, and there's no grudges, there's no I'm going for the D word and we're getting out of this marriage, none of that. You just remain totally committed, and each of you know in a relationship, for example, that's the way it is. That nothing is going to change that. Okay, we're getting to the last one because I know it's getting on. Well, before we get to the last one, what is commitments? Commitment, whatever happens, I'll keep building this relationship and I'll keep being the leader. And in the case of marriage, it's a team relationship of two. And the team leader is, scripturally speaking, the husband. He doesn't necessarily adopt that as something that is a power thing. Sometimes he has to be encouraged to be the leader by his spouse. Team of two, both committed to each other. Okay. Oh, I love this. This is the last one. Routines. I think there is a lot to be said in any relationship for routines. And it's basically saying that we do the same things each day in an efficient, organised way. We have set routines, unchanging behaviours, because routines define that word that is a very slippery word that we discussed earlier today. Routines define
culture, readings, prayer, attendance at meetings, chores, keeping things simple.
You're going to put the hat around for my poor children here, because sometimes they get back for a week. We don't believe in allowances in our home. Now, if you do, that's fine, I respect that. We've chosen not to.
And the reason why we've chosen not to is there's a lot of chores, particularly on a farm where we are. There's a lot of things that we've got to do. And we do them. And we disperse them. And they get paid or they don't get paid, depending upon their attitude and their responsiveness for getting into the routines and into the machinery of our lives. Okay? And they get paid for that. And if they've chosen to be lazy, they get nothing. And, you know, if it's folding the clothes off the line, great. I won't embarrass them, but one of my sons does all the ironing in our home. It's a routine because it's part of our culture, and we want to imbibe this whole idea of culture. And culture is the attitudes and behaviours that we encourage or discourage. It's all about, brothers and sisters, creating a circumstance where when they leave home, they carry with them this culture with them, so that when they're in other people's homes, and I'm not necessarily bagging out anyone here or anyone in particular, not having anyone in mind, usually in a non-Christadelphian environment, they will say, oh, look, you know, those people, all they're doing is watching DVDs all day and playing on their iPhones. And, you know, their culture is empty. You want to know something? If their culture is empty, so are they. All right, well, that's pretty much it. And thank you for putting up with a lot of stuff, which is very challenging in many ways. But leadership, as we said, brethren and sisters, and brethren in particular, is in short supply in our culture, and it can introduce itself into the ecclesia. Let's try our hardest to develop leadership in our families in this terribly godless age.